Moses comes down the mountain one time with these laws. You know them. They're called the Ten Commandments. It's always an interesting exercise to ask people to write out the Ten Commandments. And everyone writes 10 things, and rarely are they all exactly the Ten Commandments. They're all good things that God's people should be doing, but we know them. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourself a carved image, no idols. You shall not take the Lord's name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Honor your father and your mother. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. You shall not covet. 10 laws that are eventually going to become 613 laws that God gives over this period of time as they're being formed and melded into a nation of God's people. 613 of these laws. Now, I hope this doesn't shock you, but you know, sometimes once a law has been written, people kind of amend it and change it and add on to it, right? That happens. And what had happened since the time Moses came with these laws to the time that Jesus is going to walk on earth, that the powers that be, the self-appointed keepers of the law, the God's law, have made it so convoluted that it was almost impossible for anyone to truly live by their definition, their understanding of all 613 of these laws. And these people kept the laws, and they made sure you kept them too. But now Jesus is bursting onto the scene. And we're in this sermon series, Sermon on the Mount. Just as Moses went up on the mountaintop, so too does Jesus go up on the mountaintop. But these rulers, these religious rulers, were taking a look at this Christian movement that was afoot, and they started throwing penalty flags at him. You see, they were being accused. They were under attack for violating these laws, violating the Sabbath law, lax observances of fasting laws, not keeping the rituals of the faith, and what's worse, eroding morals by being with those people, tax collectors, sinners, prostitutes. That can't be right. And so Jesus' Jewishness was really being called into question. And so Jesus is going to refute all of this kind of mentality by making a statement of complete fidelity to Moses. And so if you have your pew Bibles open, turn to Matthew chapter 5. I'm going to be reading in a couple different sections. I'm going to start with verse 17. It's also on your bulletin front and will be up on the screen. And so Jesus says this, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have come not to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter into the kingdom of heaven." Your righteousness needs to be above that of that which these keepers of the law are currently exhibiting. Jesus didn't come to abolish the law, didn't come to throw away the Old Testament. No, he came to fulfill it and to bring it to an even higher level of righteousness. He wanted to get people back to the original intent of what God gave to Moses. Now, we have this tendency to kind of discount those laws, they're antiquated. We have a tendency maybe even to discount all of the Old Testament. But I want to say some sharp words to you. I believe it is nearly impossible to truly know who Jesus is if we don't have a good understanding of the Old Testament, of the womb to which he was born. I have a new membership class that we're doing right now, and Tomorrow night is class 201. We're meeting in the chapel, and anyone can come to that. 201, next tomorrow night, I'm going to be talking about the United Methodist Church, our history, our polity, what we believe in, our key tenets. But in 101, I tell the entire story of the history of Christianity in less than 30 minutes. And I do it by drawing a picture, and I start with a cross. I start with a cross. I say, it all begins right here, a cross, an empty tomb, the day of Pentecost. The church is born. And so then I draw a vertical line that represents 1,000 years. For 1,000 years, roughly, there was just the church. Just the church. And then at about a year 1,000, there was a split. And so I draw a Y. So our straight line that starts with the cross ends up in a Y. One is the Eastern Christians, our brothers and sisters that have a different practice. Same God, different practice. And then the other one goes to Rome. We get to 819 East Silver Spring, 116 years ago, through Rome. That's the path that we took. And then I, about halfway up that Y line, I draw another line back to the center. That's Martin Luther, who wanted to get the church back to what the church really was. And but then there's some splinters. We have Zwingli, we have Calvin, and we draw all these things. And what ends up happening is it's a family tree. It's the Christianity's family tree. And then I draw a line under the cross to signify the earth. And then I draw a root system. A root system. And that root system is the Old Testament. It is Judaism. It is God's chosen people. It is that root system that nourishes us, that has given us life so that we might grow into a beautiful and diverse tree of people who are in love with Jesus Christ. So Jesus is trying to get people back to the true intent of what this is. And so he starts saying things like, you've heard it said in the law this, but I say to you that. To get it deeper, to a higher level of righteousness. You've heard it said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. You've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. You've heard it said, you shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you have made to the Lord. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, and it gets a deeper level of righteousness. So let's take a look just to illustrate this with one of these. I'm picking back up in verse 21. You have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you'll be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you'll be liable to the council. And if you say, you fool, you'll be liable to the hell of fire. So when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother or sister, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're on the way to court with him, or your accuser may hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard, and you'll be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. If you murder someone, you're liable to judgment. We know that. But to this higher level of righteousness that Jesus is trying to get us back to, he says, even if you are angry, you are liable to judgment. And so in this section, we see these fractured relationships, things that are unreconciled. And Jesus says, you got to take care of that if you really truly want to come and worship with a clean and pure heart. Clean and pure heart. Anger. We all struggle to manage it. We all struggle to keep it under control. And yes, some people may get angry less, but each and every one of us in this room knows what it's like to be angry. I do premarital sessions, and I'm doing premarital work for Christy West, and she was with her fiance in my office yesterday, and one of the questions I ask the partner is, tell me what your fiance is like when they're mad. And the fiance just has to listen to it and take it. And so people start to describe what their partner, this person that they love so much that they're about to take a vow of fidelity to, and they explain what this person's like, and sometimes the person's surprised. We think we know what we're like when we're mad, but that might not even be close to what is real, what the person that we love is experiencing. Anger is everywhere, and it has become an infectious disease. Anyone been mad over politics in your lifetime? Anyone ever been mad at your own home or in your car? On the freeway, I get mad quite often, I confess. I'm a sinner saved by the grace of God. I get mad when I'm driving on Silver Spring and people are being crazy. I'm not the only one mad, although I'm not the one with the hand gestures. I keep it on the wheel, keep it on the wheel, keep it locked in. People are, our anger has worked its way into sporting events. We've seen images of people getting into fistfights at a game. I've seen people angry inside 819 East Silver Spring. No church is immune to anger. Some social commentators have said we are living in an age of rage. Have we ever heard that? An age of rage. So anger. It is, friends, a legitimate emotion. Anger is a legitimate emotion often expressed illegitimately. A legitimate emotion often expressed illegitimately. It really should serve as a warning light to us, just like our car dashboard that says service, check engine light comes on. We know we need to do something. When we feel ourselves getting angry, we really should be warned and then make the appropriate decisions, but we don't. And so there are some real dangers with anger. I want to list three of them. The first real danger of anger is that it is dangerously contagious. Anger is dangerously contagious. We were talking baseball a little bit earlier in our celebration. Many of you know Mickey Mantle and Billy Martin. They were longtime teammates for the Yankees. They had a lot of fun. It's a good thing they weren't doing what they were doing in the day and age like we have now with our media. It would be a field day. But they made arrangements to go hunting. Mickey Mantle had somebody who was going to let them drive out to their ranch and go hunting. And so they pulled up to the ranch, and Mickey said, "Bill, you stay in the car. I'm just going to go and talk to the landowner to see if there's a certain part of the land he wants us to hunt in." And when Mickey got to the door, the gentleman was happy to see him. What an honor to have Mickey Mantle at my door and to hunt my land. But he said, "You know, Mickey, I've had this mule, and it's time for this mule to be euthanized, to be put down, but I don't have the heart to do it. You know, I call this mule name. We've spent so many hours together. Please, would you just put this mule down for me?" And so Mickey said, "Okay." Well, on the way back to the car, Mickey had the idea. And so he worked his face to be real red, and he got tight, and he pretended to be mad. He got into the car, slammed the door, and said, "That old son of a gun changed his mind. We can't go hunting here. He goes, "Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go in that barn. I'm going to shoot the first thing I see." And so he takes his gun out, slams the door, walks into the barn, puts the mule down. And as he's turning around to walk back to the car, he hears two more shots. And there's Billy Martin, red in his face, you know, foaming at the mouth. "I showed that son of a gun. I just shot two of his cows." Anger can be dangerously contagious. How often can a crowd of people be worked up into a mob mentality? People who weren't angry at all before can get so worked up, and then some dangerous things can happen. The second danger of anger is it makes us do some of the most stupid things imaginable. When anger gets the best of us, we do some really stupid things. Many of you know I'm an avid golfer, and I'm proud to say I am not a club thrower. I don't helicopter my clubs around. I've played with guys that have bent a putter over their head. I've heard all kinds of things. I have enough to be angry about with my own golf game, but I don't do that. But this one man was out playing with his buddies, and he hit his tee shot into the water, hit a second shot in the water, hit his third shot in the water, and so he drove up to the lake, and we thought he was going to take a drop, but instead he took the bag of clubs off his cart and helicoptered it into the water, got in the cart and drove away. His friends couldn't believe it. They were going to finish. Well, even before they finished the hole, they see his cart coming back. The man slams on the brakes, walks into the water, picks up the golf bag, takes his car keys out of the thing, and then throws it back in there. Anger can cause us to do some really stupid, hurtful, harmful things. Things that can fracture that which was previously whole. So my pastoral advice to you this day, if people say, what did your pastor say? Remember this, don't do stupid things. And anger is a conduit to a lot of that. But what Jesus was getting to is this third danger in anger. And Jesus speaks directly to it in the passage I just read. An angry heart has no room for worship. An angry heart, a bitter heart, a resentful heart has no room for worship, no room to be filled. And so there are ways in which it shows that we could be explosive and blowing up, we could be stewing or brewing, we could be silent, we could be irritable, but silent anger, friends, is just as offensive to God as explosive anger. Let me say that again. Silent anger is just as offensive to God as explosive anger. It has gone from being something that is uniquely human to something that is sinful. And so how are you prone to express your anger? So let me give you quickly three ways to overcome this. And the first way to overcome anger is to search yourself, to know yourself. In the premarital session, right after we talk about what we're like when we're angry, we talk about using I messages. Because when we're angry, we want to say you and poke someone in the chest, and that's just going to escalate the anger. No, we need to use our I messages, I feel. And when we're searching for the time to get these I messages, we ask ourselves questions, what is it about this that has me reacting this way? What is it about me that has me feeling this way? And so if we're going to really search ourselves and try and use these I messages, that means we have to incorporate something that is going to work my way into a sermon at least once a year, probably about once a year, and that is soul time. Soul time. And soul time is the amount of time it takes for a stimulus to turn around into a response. If someone slaps me on the cheek and I slap him right back, my response has had zero time to sit in my soul, which means God has not had an opportunity, has not been invited into this process so that I might respond in a loving, Christ-like way. Spend time with your soul so that every action response would be a soulful response. A second way to overcome anger is to really try and see it from the other person's point of view. That quote, be kind because everyone is fighting a great battle. We have no idea what it is. That person who is short with us, we have no idea what maybe they're really dealing with, what kind of news they have just received. That car that speeds by us, we have no idea that they may be going to an emergency of some kind. Be kind. Be kind. But the last thing that we need to do to overcome anger should really be the first, second, and third thing. And it was voiced so lovely in our prayer this morning. The third way to overcome anger is to pray. To pray. Lord, take this anger away from me. Lord, take this resentment away from me so that I might have a heart that can truly be pure and worship you. You don't need to only confess your anger. You need to ask God to empower you to exercise control and flee the sin of anger. Friends, we have a God who comes to our aid when we cry out. Anger is a troublesome emotion. No one is immune. And in the end, it leaves us separated from our friends, from our colleagues, from our family members as we hold on to that anger. Every minute you remain angry, you give up 60 seconds of peace of mind, is what Emerson said. And so the time has come for us to learn how to be good when mad. To learn how to be good when mad. And it begins with Jesus Christ. This reconciliation begins with the one who reconciled the world unto himself. And so let us reconcile with each other so that we may be freed to have hearts that can worship fully, freed from anger and full of love. And so what anger, bitterness, resentment are you holding on to? What do you need to go and reconcile before truly being able to come to this altar? What's it going to take for you to let go of your anger? And so for 116 years, Methodists at 819 East Silver Spring have been trying to overcome anger by walking with one another. And many of those who have walked this journey over the last 116 years have lived by words like Henry Nouwen's: did I offer peace today? Did I bring a smile to someone's face? Did I say words of healing? Did I let go of my anger and resentment? Did I forgive? Did I love? These are the real questions. I must trust that the little bit of love that I sow now will bear many fruits here in this world and in the life to come. Amen.